This is an interview with Charles William Burgess at his home at 516 Hogarth Avenue. The date is November 10th, 1983. The interview is given by Stephen G. Papoulos for the Youngstown State University Oral History Department. Mr. Burgess, can you tell me where you were born, first of all?
In Warren, Ohio.
You lived there all most of your life, your young life?
Yeah, up until the time right into World War II.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I didn't have any.
You went to Harding High School?
That's right.
What do you remember about Harding? Were you involved in sports then? Do you remember anything?
Not the organized sports. I used to run long distance, sort of a intramural type thing, and that was about all in the sport.
What did you do after school, after high school?
I went on to college at MIT. Mm-hmm.
And then you went into the service?
Yeah, in 1943.
Mr. Burgess, what branch of the service did you go into?
I was in the infantry.
Where was your basic training at? When did you ship out?
Basic training was down in Texas. After that, they did intend to put me in the engineers corps and sent me to the University of Missouri. But at the time of the Battle of the Bulge, they got short of infantry, and they called us all back in the infantry and gave us a brush-up course and sent us over to Europe.
What do you remember about your experience there in Europe? Can you tell me any of it?
You mean in battle?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a rather odd situation. When we crossed the English Channel on Christmas Day, we had three regiments in the division, and one regiment was on each boat, and the German submarine sunk the one boat. Fortunately, I was on one of the others, and we lost a whole regiment of men, and therefore, instead of putting us into battle in the area of the Bulge, they had trapped about 100,000 Germans in Saint-Nazaire and Lorient along the Atlantic coast when they made the original invasion. So they took our division and had them surround those Germans and hold them, and the division that had been doing that took our place in the Bulge area.
You say you lost, or they lost a regiment at sea.
Well, they didn't all die, but being Christmas Day, most of them, that they went down with the boat. The crew abandoned the boat, left the men standing on the deck, and when it went down, by the time they were rescued, most of them had pneumonia, and they had to go to the hospital. It was just not an effective unit anymore. It was the boat, actually, that my regiment was supposed to be on, and at the last second they switched it.
Did you have any other experiences in combat that you think are noteworthy? Or?
Oh, there's all sorts of experiences. The fact that we were keeping the Germans bottled in, and the Germans were in that area because they had big submarine pens at Saint-Nazaire and Lorient, and they wanted to keep them operating. They didn't want out, and it was too costly to take the troops they had. So most of the fighting was patrols, skirmishes, and things like that. So we got into a lot of shelling and putting out booby traps. That happened to be one of my jobs, and things like that. The thing that impressed me the most was something that didn't happen. At the end of the war, we had been brought back to be trained to actually take the Germans in that pocket, and when Germany surrendered, those troops did not. Therefore, although it seemed extremely foolish to me, they intended to have our division attack those Germans. And I was a second scout in my outfit we were the lead elements. And needless to say, the night before we were supposed to attack, I couldn't sleep. And I was on guard duty and on a lonely road. And all of a sudden, I heard all this noise back in the camp. The guys were yelling and carrying on. And a Jeep came out of the camp, and there was a drunken officer standing up in the Jeep. And I asked him what happened, and he said that the 100,000 troops in the pocket had given up, too.
That's all right. When did you come home, then?
Well, I didn't have enough points to come home right away, so first we were sent to Marseille, France, to ship troops out to the Pacific and also to guard a German prisoner of war camp. And after that, I was sent to Vienna, Austria, as a military policeman. And I stayed there until June of 46. I didn't have to stay quite that long, but I signed up for an extra few months because I didn't want to come home over the Atlantic in the middle of winter. And since I was going back to college, the main thing was to get home before September when the school began.
You look like you'd have been a military police officer.
Well, actually, because I had told them I was a radio expert from the infantry, I didn't do much patrol work. I was in charge of the radio network for Vienna, Austria, at their headquarters.
That would have been a good job.
Yes, it was all indoors, and we scheduled our own work.
Oh, that would have been great. When you came home, then, you went to school?
Went back, yes. Might mention that originally I was an aeronautical engineer, and during the war, the aircraft industry was overbuilt. So while I was in the service, I read a lot of military manuals on electronics and things like that and decided I'd change to electrical engineer. So when I went back to MIT, I changed my major.
When did you graduate from there?
In June of 48.
And then?
Went to work for Electric Controller and Manufacturing Company in Cleveland. And I worked for them for about a year. I left there and came down to Niles. For a short period, I worked at Republic Steel. And then I got a job as an engineer with Packard Electric. And I was there until they called me back into service for the Korean War.
And you went through the same old thing in the Korean War, then?
Of the time I was training troops at Fort Knox, but they passed a law where you couldn't send anybody overseas if you had less than 6 months to go. When they passed that law, they grabbed all of us and sent us overseas to make sure we got over there. But the total length of service was only about 17 months. And I was home again in June, I think of 51.
Mr. Burgess, while you were overseas and in the war, what did your dad think about that?
In World War II? Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I was an only son, and it shook him up extremely. In fact, I remember the month before I went, he came down and had me write my will and helped me write it. But he was also extremely patriotic, and he was very proud of the fact that I was going to go overseas and in the Army and serve in the Army. But I know it took a terrific toll on him till I got back again.
What did your dad do during the war?
Well, of course, he was always a lawyer, but he was also head of Draft Board Number 2 in Warren. And there was 4 draft boards. That was a particular area he covered.
He might have been one of the people who took care of my uncles and my father then.
He could well be. He felt very strongly anybody should be willing to serve their country, and his draft board was considered quite tough. But my father also felt very sympathetic towards the one that went in, and he used to go down and see him off at the train and all that sort of thing. And
if a person enlisted in the service, did they go to him then, or was this just for drafting?
This is just drafting.
Oh, all this guy, all these, my dad and his brothers all enlisted.
Yeah, I enlisted myself, so I was not under, well, I was never under his draft board. I was under draft board number one, but when I enlisted, that took me out from under any draft board.
What made you enlist?
Well, I was at MIT, and to take advanced ROTC, which was the third and fourth year, you had to join the Army Reserve, and they had a very good-looking girl sign us all up, and I don't think anybody was listening, so we all signed up. And that was in the spring of 43, and by June they'd called us into service.
That's all right. That's a mean trick. Where was your dad from? What can you tell me about his birthplace and so on?
He was born in Willoughby, Ohio. My grandfather worked for the railroad. And he had two brothers and a sister. And they didn't have a lot of money. And so he went out. He did go to Western Reserve University for a little while, but he never finished there. And he went out to Kansas and was a cowhand for a number of years. And he saved his money out there, and he finally went to Kansas University to study law, and he worked his way through the university, washed dishes and things like that, and managed to get his law degree. And then he came back to this area again. And then he was in World War I, and he contracted something like polio. So when he came back from World War I, he went back out to Kansas to the Tom Briggs Ranch. That's where he had been before, and he spent a considerable amount of time out there till he got his health back. And then he came back to this area again.
He sounds like he was a very determined person.
Yes, he was.
To overcome something like that.
He had about pulled himself up by his own bootstraps.
Was he from a poor family?
Well, that's what I say. They had an adequate living, but they couldn't afford to send him to college or anything like that. And he always had jobs when he was growing up. And as I say, he earned his way through college.
Did he ever relate to you any experiences he had in World War I?
Oh, various ones. Sometimes he was telling them because they were amusing, and other times to show how bad a war can be. He was in the Red Cross. His eyes were so bad that they would not take him in the infantry. He volunteered for the infantry. And when they wouldn't take him in the infantry, he joined the Red Cross, and he was made a captain. And in those days, the Red Cross went out on the battlefield with stretchers and brought the wounded in. And he used to describe some of that. And I remember he was describing when Armistice Day came, and that was quite interesting because, like always in the Army, there's so many rumors, and nobody was really sure it was true this time, and everybody had quit shooting, but nobody wanted to stick their head up to find out whether the war was really over or not. And but then when it finally became obvious it was, why the enemy troops and the Allied troops were mixing up together and everything else. They were talking to each other and so forth.
What are some of your earliest recollections of your dad? I want to try and develop his personality. What can you tell me that would point that out?
Well, my mother died when I was 6 years old. And that's about as early as I can remember. I can remember my father taking my mother and I down to Florida for my health. My health wasn't good when I was young. And I can remember him at the railroad station and so forth. And Then when we came back from Florida, my mother contracted pneumonia and finally died of a heart attack. And that's the earliest I can remember my father.
How old would your dad be when she died?
About, 42, somewhere around there. I was 6 years old, and he got married in his late middle 30s.
Did your dad ever marry again?
Yes, but he didn't marry until I was in World War II. He always worried whether a stepmother would treat me right, and he was always reluctant to remarry.
Can I use that in the story?
Yes, I don't care. While I was overseas in World War II, he met a woman, I think it was during a political campaign, and she happened to have been married to a man who had been the son of a close friend of my father's, and he had died, and they got married while I was in Europe.
You mentioned a political campaign. What do you mean? What was he involved with?
Well, my father was always involved in politics to a certain extent. Of course, he had been prosecutor back in those days. He was active, running as a candidate, but he always was interested in politics, and he went to the party meetings and things like that. And I can't remember the exact position, but I think the woman who married Dorothea Van Gorder was working for the sheriff at that time, and they were giving one of the political parties, I don't know, they were celebrating a win or what it was, and he was there and he met her, and they got to going together and finally decided to get married. She had been the daughter, or she'd been married to the son of Colonel Van Gorder, who was a close friend of my father's.
I know a Van Gorder family now in Warren, Ohio. Delbert is about my age. Do you know who the Van Gorders now?
No. My father's wife was a Corbin, and that was the Warren Marble and Granite company that made all the tombstones right down across from the Warren City Cemetery. And she came from that family. I think Van Gorder himself, not the colonel, but his son, the one she had been married to, worked for Ohio Edison. Hmm. Yeah, is one of their executives.
Your father seems to be a person who's very, very concerned about you and your well-being.
Yes, and of course, because there was only he and I, we spent a lot of time together. We went on vacations together, and he was very much a home man. Shortly after my mother died, we tried several housekeepers and so forth, but finally we got a woman who was with us from the time I was about 7 years old till I went to college. And so the three of us lived at the house, and she got my father very interested in gardening. In fact, we got so interested in gardening that the Garden Club of Ohio used to come down and tour our gardens. We bought a whole extra lot on Woodbine and Warren, 60 foot wide by about 200 deep, and it was in all in lawns, trees, flowers, and so forth. And he devoted most of his time to gardening, and for sports and so forth, he hunted and fished. He didn't have an extensive social life, and he spent most of his time at home or on some vacation fishing somewhere. And a lot of that time, of course, I was with him.
How successful was he as an attorney?
quite successful. His specialty was trial type, jury type cases. That's what he really enjoyed. And he was considered a very good lawyer, and people went to him because if they were really in trouble and they needed a good lawyer, he would not put up with clients that lied or did not tell the truth and tried to fool him or anything like that. Probably wasn't the most easygoing lawyer, but he was very good in the courtroom.
Was he a strict person?
Yes, he was strict. He had a very highly developed sense of justice, and he wasn't too tolerant of people that broke the law or didn't have a fairly good high code of living.
Can you give me any examples of your father and his attitude?
Well, I think the thing he detested most was lying. And if you ever tried to lie to an ex-prosecuting attorney, you'd realize how difficult it would be as a child. And you were far better off to tell the truth and take your punishment than to lie and get caught. And he always impressed on me that once you get established as a liar, then when you're telling the truth, nobody's going to believe you. And so it was a very strong point with him. And he was a strict disciplinarian. He believed in physical punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably got molded in somewhat the same image because of his upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see him in court?
No, not normally. Once, I think, only. I just, out of curiosity, I thought, and I was so probably in my teens, I thought, I've never seen my father in court. I'm going in and watch him. And that's the only one I ever watched.
What was he like? Can you remember?
Well, for one thing, he had a phenomenal memory. And as a result, he would sit in the courtroom and not take notes. He'd be looking out the window or at the ceiling, and you think, doesn't he care what's going on, you know? And then when they would call on him, he would have all the facts, know exactly what he was going to ask and so forth, but he rarely jotted anything down. I presume eventually he did, but he didn't during the trial. And as a result, he was also a very good bridge player. He used to enter tournaments because he could remember everybody's cards and everything that had been played. And he was a very, as I mentioned before, he was a terrific cross-examiner. He would get you so confused and mad at him and yourself and everybody else that you'd trip yourself up if you were lying.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever talk about any of the Niles cases that he had?
No, not to me, no.
Did he ever talk about the Ku Klux Klan trials when he prosecuted people from...
He talked about the Ku Klux Klan and some of the events that occurred, but not the actual cases. He mentioned how he'd brought in the National Guard when it became obvious things were getting out of control. And... that's about, he didn't tell me too much about it, no.
Well, can you remember what his attitude was like, what he thought of these people? Did he place the blame on any particular group?
Well, he was, had no sympathy with the Klan whatsoever. he felt that, and there were a lot of prominent local people in the Klan. There wasn't all the people that came up from the southern states and so forth, although there were a lot of them that came up. There were a lot of local Klans people, and he just not could not understand how they could hold the beliefs they held, and had no sympathy with them.
Did he have any close associations with other attorneys or other people you might remember?
Well, he had partners. Originally, he was closely associated with his sister's husband, Clara Caldwell. And the two of them worked together for a number of years. Clara Caldwell was prosecuting attorney and made my father assistant. Then my father was prosecuting attorney and made Clara Caldwell assistant. And later they were practiced law together. But
how do you spell Caldwell?
C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L. He eventually acquired some sort of an affliction. They had to do with nerves in his backbone. In those days, they didn't seem to know too much about it. And Clara Caldwell got more and more crippled. Finally got to the point where he was bedfast and could not practice law. He used to go down to the YMCA in Warren to swim every noon, trying to keep himself mobile, but he just couldn't do it. And so my father had to get new partners, and I'm not sure who all of them were, but he was with a man called Patchen, and I imagine he was the senior partner because they called it Patchen and Burgess. And then later, he was with a man by the name of Lewis, and the firm was known as Burgess and Lewis.
Can you tell me about any other people that were interesting that your dad knew?
Well, back in the days shortly after Prohibition, my father represented a local racketeer by the name of Jim Muncine. He did discuss that a little with me. He emphasized the fact that he never defended Muncine if he was guilty, and he was guilty of many things. But he would defend him when he was accused of something he didn't do. And he had one particular case, and I don't really remember what the circumstances were, but they decided that they needed the very best defense, so they hired Clarence Darrow. And my father was co-counsel, and the two worked together on the case. And through this, they became fast friends, and they communicated over the years. And when Clarence Darrow was in the area, he often stayed at our house. I was so young, though, that I can remember him. However, he was in his 70s and had begun to fail mentally. His memory was bad. He could be perfectly lucid at times, but then other times he couldn't remember things. And I think my father was strongly influenced by Clarence Darrow.
How?
Well, Clarence Darrow wasn't just lawyer. He wrote all sorts of books, many of them on the law. He opposed capital punishment. He wrote books on that. But he was into biology. He was very interested in evolution, things like that. And as practically everybody knows, he defended Scopes in the monkey trial when a teacher by the name of Scopes was teaching the evolution theory in Tennessee, and he was brought to trial because there was a law in Tennessee that said you couldn't teach evolution. And Darrow had philosophies for living and all sorts of, he thought deeply on everything. He was an agnostic. Which of course means that he didn't say there is a God, he didn't say there isn't, he just said he didn't know. And, different than being an atheist. And he felt that anybody that thought they didn't know was a little conceited. And they had many discussions together, and Darrow was very much the champion of the underdog. All his career was spent defending them. many Union people, people that were charged with cases mainly because of their political beliefs rather than, and he would defend them. And my father had somewhat the same philosophy that he felt everybody was entitled to a decent defense, whatever their beliefs happened to be, or whatever their race was, or anything else like that. And
how did he reflect that?
Well, he, if there were corps in the Warren and so forth, they, you know, normally the court assigns you a lawyer if you can't afford one. And of course, most lawyers would prefer to avoid that type of duty. There's no money in it or anything like that. And my father not only didn't try to avoid it, but he often represented people that could not pay him, or at least could not pay him what a lawyer should be paid. And as a result, he had considerable influence in among those that are more in that, what you'd call the downtrodden group. And they'd often come to him, as that way we mentioned earlier, he was in politics, and they'd often come to him and ask his advice on who to vote for and things like that, and who he thought what they should do. And he had considerable influence in this respect.
And was it more in Warren, his influence?
Yeah, it's all local, because he was based in Warren. He didn't have any influence outside of Warren, but in those days, he used to represent a lot of the colored population who could not afford good lawyers. And in turn, their leaders would come to him and when there was an election and discuss things with him and ask who he thought they should vote for and things like that, you know.
Then did other politicians come to him also for help very often?
Well, he supported certain ones. He was strong in the Republican Party, and if he supported a man, he would use his influence as best he could to get the man elected. He himself, they tried to get him at various times to run for judge. However, he felt he could earn more money as a lawyer than as being judge. And he didn't want to be somebody that decided to be a judge after he was too old to be a lawyer, because he felt it might not serve the public to the extent they should be served. So he never did run for judge, although at the time he was retiring, they tried to get him to run. He used to substitute a lot for the judges when they were on vacation, things like that.
Did your father know prosecutor by the name of Birrell, B-I-R-R-E-L-L?
Yeah, so he was a neighbor of ours, in fact. So we grew up together, his children and myself, and then they were only a block away.
What kind of man was he, do you remember?
Very honest and all that, but also very straight-laced. He was not too forgiving a man. I think later, in the later years, he mellowed a lot, but when he was younger, he was quite straight-laced, and he brought his boys up the same way. And they were very nice boys, and I don't mean it in any derogatory manner at all. But I don't know how best to say it. I don't think he viewed errant ways with a great deal of sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did he look like?
Earl? Well, he looked taller than he really was because he was a slender man that held himself very erect, and he was a very dignified-looking man. And he looked quite impressive later when he was a judge. In the earlier years there, he really looked the part.
Do you remember him? Well, see, there are certain newspaper accounts that depict him as an axe-swinging, bar-busting, anti-bootlegging law enforcement official. Do you remember
this? This was probably when I was extremely young. If it was back during Prohibition, I would have been too young to remember. No, I don't happen to remember that at all. My father was prosecuted during Prohibition and got involved in a lot of those cases. But again, the only recollection I have is what he told me about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember Burrell in those days.
Okay. When did your dad retire?
About 19... Oh, boy. 48, I'd say. Or in about 1949. I was out of MIT, and he retired before I went into the Korean War, which was only about 2 years later.
How old was he when he retired in 49?
Around 50-something. Late 50s.
Do you remember what year he was born in?
I could calculate it. It'd take me a little while. He, was 69 when he died, and he died in 1955. So, 1896. I'm sorry.
1896 he was born?
No, 1886.
1886? Okay. What did he do in his retirement years?
He retired to North Carolina, down near Hendersonville, North Carolina, which is just below Asheville. He bought a place down there, and he got enough land where he could put a large part of it into gardening. Gardening had always been a great pleasure of his. He raised corn and everything down there. And then he joined the fish and game organizations down there, and he became president of the local club there, and they stocked lakes with fish and things like that, and he just enjoyed the outdoor life. My father just as soon be outdoors as any place, and he spent all the rest of his life there until he died.
How did he die?
Cancer. He got cancer of the prostate, which spread to the his backbone. By the time they diagnosed it at the Cleveland Clinic, they had were able to remove the prostate, but it already got into the backbone, and so they said he had about 2 years to live, so that's just about what he lived. But he was able, he was working in the garden the day before he died.
Hmm. Still a determined person.
Yeah, very.
How tall was he again?
Well, he was about 5'7¾". Used to call him Sliver.
Was that his nickname?
When he was very young, when he was living at home and when he was first going to college and all that. He tried to play football, but he was only 5'7¾", and I don't know what he weighed. I think it's 130-something. And his brothers, who were real bruisers, used to call him Sliver and the Cuban sufferer, because at that time, Cuba had a lot of people starving to death, I guess, and things like that. And his most proudest moment in football at Western Reserve was when he was the only person between his famous halfback and the goal line, and he got ran over.
Is there anything else that you would want noted about your dad that we didn't cover?
I can't think of anything right now. I may later, but I can't right now. My father was very much an outdoors type man, interested in fishing and hunting. And all through my childhood, every summer, we took a 2 weeks
vacation up into Canada and to a fishing place, and it was far enough back so it took you an hour just to drive about the last 10 miles because the road was so bad. And he was never satisfied to stay at the base camp, which had a farmhouse hotel of sorts and different cabins. I used to get a guide and canoes and portage from lake to lake and rivers, and live in deserted trappers' cabins. We carried our own food, but the rule up there is if you're going to survive is that you can use anybody's cabin. They don't lock them. And you don't use the supplies if you have your own. You just use the place and leave it like it was in case somebody else gets really in trouble. And we'd be gone for 3 and 4 days like that, catching fish and before we came back to the main camp.
How old was he about then?
Well, this was while I was growing up, so mostly it was around when I was 12 on up to, well, even after I came back from World War II, he went up there. And so that would have made him around his early 50s, I'd say, and late 40s. He'd go up with friends that had similar taste that would go on the same trips with us. And he did a lot of hunting around here, both with a shotgun and rifle. And at one time, he was on the state of Ohio rifle team. He used to enter competition. And he had a quite expensive bolt-action 22 he used in target work, designed like the old Army Springfield. And one of the interesting things about it was that he had a scope mounted on it, and this the scope for the rifle was one he picked up on the battlefield in World War I. A German sniper had it mounted on his rifle, and the scope had apparently been made by a doctor in Germany. It wasn't a German Army issue, and my father brought it home and mounted it on his rifle, which he used in competition, and then he also used it in hunting. He was hunting something small game like squirrel or something.
Did your dad ever do any writing or anything like this? Did he have anything published?
No, I don't think he did. I don't remember, other than regular legal briefs or something like that. He never wrote any books.
Any documents for magazines, anything like that?
No, I don't.
Like Darryl?
I don't believe he did, no.
Okay, good.